The name on the warrant was Vincent Martin. The warrant itself was almost beside the point. By the time Kingston woke on the morning of September 1, 1948, the warrant had already been rendered irrelevant by everything that happened after 10 o'clock the night before. A dead detective on the floor of the Carib Hotel on Regent Street. Two other officers bleeding in the back of a car on the way to Kingston Public Hospital, and a 5'3" man in his underwear moving barefoot through the tenement blocks of Hannahtown with a bullet in his right shoulder and both guns still in his hands. The police had cordoned off the neighborhood. They had sealed every lane from Regent Street to Trinity and Blount and Dumfries. They were certain they had him. They were wrong. He was already gone. And somewhere in his wake, somewhere in the gap between the hotel corridor and the Spanish Town Road, between the blood he left on the floor and the blood he was about to spill, there was a question nobody in the Kingston Constabulary would fully answer for decades. Who told him the police were coming? Who had been watching the Carib Hotel that Tuesday night and recognized the plainclothes officers moving into position? The Gleaner later described his intelligence network as a team of spies and documented treetop sentries and organized lookouts. But the names behind that network, the chain of people who sustained a fugitive through the biggest manhunt in Jamaican history, never appeared in any courtroom. That thread, that web of silent loyalty woven through the yards and rum bars of West Kingston, is the thing about Riging the official record never explained, and never tried to. To understand why people protected him, you have to understand the Jamaica that produced him. In 1948, Jamaica was still a British colony, and had been for nearly three centuries. The Crown's formal presence had been eroding. Universal adult suffrage had arrived in 1944, and the labor rebellions of 1938 had shaken the plantation economy so violently that London was forced to begin renegotiating the terms of its Caribbean possessions. But renegotiation was not the same as relief. In the tenement yards of West Kingston, in the sprawling, crumbling blocks of Hannahtown, Denhamtown, Bacow Wall, and the corrugated iron settlements spreading west toward Spanish Town Road, the daily reality of black Jamaican life remained defined by overcrowding, chronic unemployment, contaminated water, and an institutional apparatus, courts, police, magistrates, that existed primarily to protect the interests of those who already had something to protect. A young man arriving from the countryside, as so many did in those decades, stepping off a bus onto the noise and heat of King Street, with nothing but ambition and a willingness to work, would find the formal economy closed to him at almost every level. What he found instead were the yards, the higglers, the sound systems, the small crimes that could be committed without equipment or connection, and the company of other young men equally compressed by the same invisible ceiling. Vincent Ivanhoe Martin was born in 1924 in Linstead, St. Catherine, a market town in the interior, far enough from Kingston to be shaped by a different rhythm, but close enough to know what the capital promised. His family was poor. He came to Kingston as a teenager. He was small, 5'3", walking with a distinctive bop, heels on his shoes to gain the inches he wasn't given, teeth missing from the front of his mouth, a voice that people consistently described as effeminate, speaking quickly and over his shoulder. He moved through the western yards with the wary alertness of a man who understood that in those streets, size was not the only currency. Reputation was, and reputation could be built. At 14, he was already appearing before the Kingston Resident Magistrate's Court, convicted of a vicious attack, sentenced to 12 strokes of the tamarind switch. If the colonial justice system understood that punishment as corrective, the correction did not take. 2 years later, 1940, another conviction for wounding, he paid the 30-shilling fine and walked in December 1943, shop-breaking. 6 months in the St. Catherine District Prison, released, quiet for 3 years, then re-emerging in the criminal world under new names that told the story of where his imagination lived. Alan Ladd, after the Hollywood cowboy who moved through Western pictures with a cool economy of violence. Captain Midnight, after the American radio serial hero, he was reading detective novels obsessively and watching American films at the Kingston Cinemas, absorbing the grammar of the outlaw hero as though studying for an examination he intended to pass. By 1946, he had organized a gang and was its leader. On February 6, 1946, he was arrested again, two counts of burglary and larceny, illegal possession of a firearm, and a separate five-year burglary sentence running concurrently, totaling 7 years at the General Penitentiary. He served two of them. On the morning of April 30, 1948, Vincent Martin went through a window of the maximum security General Penitentiary and did not come back. How exactly he did it, whether alone, whether assisted, whether the window had been chosen in advance and the route rehearsed, the records do not say. What the records do say is that an island-wide manhunt began immediately and produced nothing. For 5 months, the most wanted man in Jamaica moved through the city that was looking for him, read its newspapers, and waited. He would not wait much longer. Consider what those 5 months meant in terms of logistics. He had no political patron protecting him, no garrison wall behind which he could disappear under organized cover. Those structures were still a generation away, still waiting for the tribal politics of the 1960s and 70s to build them. What he had was something older and more informal, the loyalty of people who had no reason to trust the police more than they trusted him. In the yards of West Kingston, an escaped convict on a manhunt was not automatically a threat to be turned in for £200. He was a neighbor, a cousin of someone's friend, a man who had grown up in the same compressed heat as everyone else. The Gleaner itself acknowledged this when it reported on September 8, 1948. The whisper went the rounds in Kingston's West End yesterday that criminal elements of the city's population had declared war against the police and were actively aiding the two-gun killer in evading the police. The police had no cooperation. Then, as now, the night of August 31, 1948, changed everything. The Criminal Investigation Department had received a tip. Rijing was at the Carib Hotel on Regent Street in Hanna Town, holed up in a room with a female companion. The CID moved carefully, officers in plain clothes, some dressed as women to obscure their identity, posted in adjacent rooms and at every exit. What they were walking into, they believed, was a clean arrest of a cornered man with a bullet already in his shoulder from a previous skirmish. What they walked into instead was the defining moment of Rijing's legend. At just after 10 o'clock that Tuesday night, the officers closed on the door. Inside, Rijing had already seen the flashlight through the gap between rooms. He had already understood what it meant. Later, in the letter he sent to the Gleaner, he described it precisely. "I called out, 'Who is that?' And the answer was the sound of a gun. I called again. Another shot was fired. Still no answer. I then know what has happened. I decided to make a dash. He came through the door in his underpants with a pistol already drawn. Detective Corporal Edgar Lewis was shot dead on the floor. Detective Haechi Earl was shot and wounded. Ex-Sergeant Gallimore, a retired officer pulled from his bed to assist with the operation, was shot and wounded. A bullet struck Rijing in the right shoulder. He kept going. He came out into the street and found more officers." The Gleaner described the scene as reminiscent of Chicago gangster days. "He fired into the crowd of plainclothes men. He ran into the block of tenements, bounded by Regent Street, Trinity Lane, Blount Street, and Dumfrey Street. The police sealed the perimeter and searched through the night. He was not there. He had already moved west. At approximately 1:30 in the morning, a man knocked on the door of a home at 257 Spanish Town Road. He was barefoot. He had a bullet wound in his shoulder. He was looking for Eric Mossban Goldson, the man he was now certain had given his location to the CID. Goldson's close friend, Lucilda Tibby Young, answered the door. She was a young woman. She was not Goldson. She told the wounded man at her door that Goldson was not there. According to reporting in the Jamaica Times and confirmed by the Jamaica Observer and the Gleaner Archive, what happened next took less than a second. Rijing shot Lucilda Young once in the chest, and she died where she stood. He shot two other women in the room, Estella Brown and Iris Bailey, wounding both. One of them hid under a bed. He left. Lucilda Young was the first civilian he killed. She died because she was in the wrong room on the wrong night, because a man she likely barely knew had informed on another man, and because Rijing, bleeding and enraged and moving through the dark with the entire Kingston police force somewhere behind him, had decided that proximity to his enemy was close enough. She was not a combatant in any war. She was not a symbol of colonial authority. She was a young woman asleep in her home. The yards that would later protect Rijing's legend also contained her unmarked grief, and that grief, quiet, unheroic, easily swallowed by the mythology growing around the man who killed her, is the part of the story that the folk hero narrative almost always elides. By dawn, Kingston knew Alexander Bustamante, the labor leader, national hero, and mayor of the capital who would within 4 years become the nation's first prime minister, attended Detective Corporal Edgar Lewis's funeral as a pallbearer and announced a £200 reward for Rijing's capture, dead or alive. All police leave was canceled. Every station in the city was put on full alert. Armory stores were broken open, and Webley revolvers issued to constables who had previously been armed only with rifles. Private citizens began loaning their cars to the police to cover more ground. The newspapers ran the story every day, sometimes on the front page, sometimes not, but always running it, and Rijing read them. He sent a letter to Detective Sergeant Scott at the Halfway Tree Police Station. It was published in the Jamaica Times, and immediately became one of the most remarkable documents in the history of Jamaican crime. I have an arsenal of 29 shots, and I am satisfied that I have made history for the criminal element in Jamaica. Don't think that I am going to kill myself because this will only serve to spoil my great record, but I hope that Detective Scott will train his men some more. I am going to show the police force what is lacking and what I can do. He was 23 years old. He had a bullet wound in his right shoulder. He was hiding in a city that was devoting every available police resource to finding him, and he was writing letters to named detectives for publication. This is the thing about Rijing, that no amount of source verification can fully explain, and no clinical analysis can reduce to a single motive. He understood that the story being told about him in the newspaper was not just a record of events. It was a weapon. Every letter he sent added to the terror. Every taunt directed at a named officer made the police look slow and exposed and human. Every day the manhunt failed, his legend grew by precisely the amount of the failure. He was not merely evading the law. He was narrating his own evasion in real time, in print, for the entertainment of the very population the law was supposed to protect. And that population jammed into the yards, reading the Gleaner in the rum bars and the Higgler's stalls and the tenement doorways, was entertained. On September 3, 1948, before dawn, he walked up to 48-year-old Jonathan Thomas on Waltham Park Road as Thomas was walking with his wife and shot him dead in the street. Thomas was a Higgler, an ordinary working man. The motive, if Rijing had one beyond the compounding chaos of his own fugitive logic, was never established to any verified standard. That same morning, he went to a home at 59½ Spanish Town Road and confronted a man named Selvin Maxwell. He intended to kill Maxwell. Maxwell fought back, overpowered him, and managed to wrench one of the guns from Rijing's hands. Rijing took Maxwell's car and drove it into the police dragnet that was already converging on the area. He slipped through again. Three people were now dead, several wounded. The city's entire police apparatus had been hunting him for days and had nothing. It was around this point, deep in the first week of September, with the manhunt at maximum pressure and the newspaper coverage feeding a citywide state of fear, that a photographer appeared in the story. His name was Mr. Brown, and he was someone Rijing knew. Raijing posed for him, stood still somewhere in Kingston, with both revolvers drawn, and let a man with a camera take his photograph. The image ran in the press. It showed a small man staring straight into the lens, with an expression that resisted easy categorization. Not quite defiant, not quite serene, but deliberate, absolutely deliberate. This was not a man surprised by a camera. This was a man who had decided that a photograph existed for the same reason a letter existed, to construct a public image that would outlast the moments it documented. When Brown gave the photograph to the press, Ruggin responded with another letter. This one went to the Daily Gleaner directly, addressed from wherever he was hiding, naming Brown alongside Detective Scott, Eric Goldson, and Selvin Maxwell as men who would answer for what they had done. The letter also gave his first-person account of the Carib Hotel shootout, the flashlight through the wall, the unanswered calls, the decision to move. "I see the men mean to make the end of me tonight, but I intend to carry someone with me." The police assessed the letter as authentic. It contained details of the hotel operation that had not been made public, information that could only have come from someone who was inside that room. By the second week of September, the manhunt had taken on dimensions that strained the capacity of a colonial police force operating in a pre-radio era. Some 300 officers cordoned off Springfield Gardens in eastern Kingston while water police craft patrolled the adjacent harbor. Carloads of detectives swept through the western lanes every night. Citizens who could arm themselves did. The Gleaner reported that householders were keeping round-the-clock watches and that telephones at city stations jangled unceasingly with tips, most of them false, some well-meaning, all of them followed up regardless. Sightings poured in from every corner of the city simultaneously. Raijing on a chrome-plated bicycle on Waltham Park Road, Raijing in an Austin car, Raijing in an unmarked 1937 Ford without license plates, Raijing at a movie theater, Raijing in Tower Street, wearing iron-blue trousers and a black felt hat. He could not possibly have been in all of these places. But the fact that people were reporting him everywhere, that half of Kingston believed he was watching them personally from some unseen position, was itself a form of power. There was a moment during this period reported quietly in the Gleaner, not fully explained, never followed up in any record that has been publicly surfaced, when an officer at a police station barracks claimed that Raijing had entered his room in the night, turned the light on, spoken to him, turned the light off and disappeared. The Gleaner noted that speculation was divided between dream and hallucination. But by then, as C. Roy Reynolds wrote in his 2000 Gleaner series, many, including the police, had come to believe that Martin could do almost anything. The rational city was becoming a city of rumor and ghost story. Raijing had not just evaded the police. He had gotten inside their heads. He also reportedly phoned a government minister's home on Espute Avenue, threatening both the minister and Chief Minister Bustamante personally. Whether this call was actually placed by Raijing or by someone performing his persona, by this point there were enough people willing to claim Raijing as an identity that separation was becoming difficult, was never confirmed. What was confirmed was the terror. A body found at Hunts Bay in early September briefly had the entire city convinced the manhunt was over. Police rushed to the scene. Fingerprint experts compared the dead man's prints against Raijing's file and confirmed the body was one James Baker of 170 Spanish Town Road, not Raijing. The manhunt resumed. The relief Kingston had briefly felt turned back to dread. He moved south and west. Intelligence put him eventually in the Ferry River swamp in St. Catherine, a treacherous marshland, 15 miles from the capital, hiding in a rough camp with provisions, a coat, and a set of keys. A large contingent of police moved into the swamp. They found the camp empty. They found the coat and the provisions and the keys and a cold fire. They found a high tree at the edge of the camp with marks on the bark where someone had climbed it regularly. One of Raijing's sentries had been posted in that tree and had watched the police moving into position from a quarter mile away. By the time the officers reached the camp, Raijing was already walking in the opposite direction. His network had worked exactly as it always had, silently, efficiently, with a loyalty that left no names in any record. The arrest of his mother, Francella Blackwin, and her husband, Howard Blackwin, caught dynamiting fish near the swamp, charged as accessories to murder, was the clearest evidence the state had that his support network reached into his own family. It was also a message from the authorities to anyone sheltering him. The risk of proximity had a price. It is not clear it worked. The walls were tightening regardless. By early October, the police had developed an intelligence picture gathered through the Gleaner's own embedded undercover reporter-photographer, a figure identified in the archive only by role and never by name, that Reijing was planning to leave the island. The plan, as reported by the Gleaner, was to reach a quay outside Kingston Harbor, and from there board a vessel for Cuba or the southwestern coast of Jamaica. Who had arranged this passage? Who had the contact in the fishing community? Who had identified a boat and a route and a captain willing to take a hunted man to open water, was never publicly established. That arrangement, like so much of the infrastructure surrounding Reijing, dissolved the moment it was no longer needed. On the night of October 8th, police observed him near the Greenwich Town Bridge, watching him, under instructions not to move yet, aware that any premature arrest in the dark against a man who had twice already shot his way through police cordons would likely cost another officer's life. They tracked him to the beach at Greenwich Town. He arranged passage with two fishermen in a canoe called Gloria again. The Gleaner's undercover account, published after the fact, described Reijing standing on the beach in the dark, hesitant, looking up East Avenue, uncertain whether the two men rowing could make the distance across the harbor to Lime Cay. He stood there for some time with four pairs of eyes on him from positions he could not see. He got in the boat. The canoe moved out into the harbor. The police moved on Lime Cay in the early morning hours of October 9th, 1948. What followed lasted more than an hour. One man, on a small sand quay in Kingston Harbor, with whatever ammunition he had left from the arsenal he had been managing across 6 weeks of constant movement against a full contingent of armed officers who had every incentive not to take him alive, he fought them. He was shot 5 times in the head and multiple times across his body. He was 24 years old. The body was wrapped in a sack and brought back to Kingston across the water. And then something happened that no colonial administrator would have planned for, and no police press release could have controlled. The city came out. Thousands of people lined the streets from the Kingston waterfront to the morgue. They pressed against the walls of the mortuary building. They needed to see it themselves, that this man, who had been in the newspaper every morning for 6 weeks, who had shot his way out of a cordon in his underwear, who had written letters to detectives by name, who had stood for a photograph with both guns drawn, and then threatened the photographer, that this man was actually, physically, finally dead. Eric Goldson, the informer whose name had appeared in every one of Reijing's published letters, reportedly stood at the mortuary and looked at the body. His words, as recorded by the Gleaner, "The race is not for the swift. Reijing, you gone at last. The authorities buried him quickly. Reclined to the post to Endurvold at the Swigwitklai." They announced to the crowd gathered near the mortuary that the body was being taken to Spanish Town for burial, a deliberate misdirection, and while the crowd moved in that direction, a small party consisting of two constables, an undertaker named Madden, and his assistants drove to Maypen Cemetery in Kingston. The burial was conducted without ceremony, without a marker, without a name on stone. Only a number marked the spot. The colonial administration understood, even then, that a marked grave was an invitation for something they did not want to encourage. Better the earth without a sign. Better nothing that could be found and held and visited and gradually transformed into a shrine. It did not work. You cannot bury a myth in an unmarked pauper's grave. The myth does not require a location. Within weeks, Kingston was already processing what had happened. The Gleaner ran a long retrospective headline. Who was this man with a price on his head? The comedians Bim and Bam staged a theatrical production called Reijing's Ghost, and audiences came, the name moved into the vocabulary of the Yards and stayed there. In 1965, Prince Buster, the Ska Don, the sound system warrior, one of the architects of early Jamaican popular music, put Rijing's name on a record. Louise Bennett Coverley, Miss Lou herself, the great poet of Jamaican vernacular speech and folk culture, wrote a poem in 1966 called Dead Man, wrestling in patois with the uncomfortable moral weight of a man the people knew was wrong and could not stop identifying with. Scholars who later analyzed the poem noted that it holds two competing responses simultaneously: acceptance of the moral propriety of his necessary demise, and the vicarious thrill of identification with his apparently indomitable badness. Miss Lou was not resolving the contradiction. She was naming it. The contradiction, she understood, was the point. Then came Perry Henzel. In 1972, Henzel, a white Jamaican director from the planter class, a man who had grown up on the other side of every wall that pressed down on the Yards of West Kingston, wrote and directed The Harder They Come. It was Jamaica's first independent feature film. Jimmy Cliff played the lead, a fictionalized version of Rijing, renamed Ivan Martin, reimagined as a country boy arriving in Kingston with a guitar instead of a pistol, trying to record music in an industry designed to exploit him, eventually driven to outlawry by the accumulated betrayals of a system that took everything and returned nothing. The film was a phenomenon in Jamaica immediately. It then reached the international market and did something nobody had predicted. It brought reggae music to the world. The soundtrack, Jimmy Cliff, Toots and the Maytals, The Melodians, Desmond Dekker, became one of the most influential album releases in the history of popular music, a document of a sound that had been building in Kingston since the late 1960s, and that the film, through sheer accident of timing and cultural momentum, detonated globally. The New York Times critic Ben Brantley later wrote that the film had launched 1,000 spliffs. Justine Henzel, Perry's daughter, described it as arriving at a perfect storm, reggae born in Jamaica in the late 1960s, a story of the oppressed man against the system, told without sentimentality, and a music so physically irresistible that it bypassed the usual gatekeepers of cultural distribution and found its audience directly. Jimmy Cliff himself described the character as a man who was very much on the side of the people, a kind of Robin Hood. The Criterion Collection, which later preserved the film, called it possibly the most influential of Jamaican films and one of the most important films from the Caribbean. All of that, every university campus screening in Britain and America, every young person who discovered reggae through that film, every subsequent documentary about Kingston and the Garrison and the Don culture that came after, traces a direct line back to a barefoot man in his underwear running through the tenement blocks of Hannahtown in the dark on August 31, 1948, with a bullet in his shoulder and two guns in his hands. But to stop there is to tell only the triumphant version of the story, and the triumphant version is incomplete. The rude boys who appeared in Kingston in the early 1960s, in the first years of Jamaican independence, in the charged atmosphere of a new nation trying to define itself against the template the colonizers had left, were the first youth subculture the island produced after independence. They dressed in sharp suits and pork pie hats and narrow ties, borrowing the silhouette of American jazz musicians and soul singers. And they moved through Kingston with a deliberate, confrontational swagger that announced their refusal to be invisible. They listened to ska. They sat at the back of buses and would not move. They built reputations in the sound system dances, where the speaker stacks stood 6 feet tall, and the competition for crowd loyalty was its own form of organized warfare. And the cultural figure they drew on, the anti-hero template they reached for when they needed a model for defiant, stylish, consequence-be-damned resistance, was Rijing. The outlaw myth of Rijing, one cultural analysis notes, loomed large, offering a folk anti-hero for the poor and dispossessed. The rude boy moment faded in Jamaica in the 1970s, as Rastafarianism and reggae offered a different spiritual grammar for the same social pressures. But the figure it had crystallized, the bad man as necessary outlaw, the Don as protector of people the state had abandoned, the violent man as folk hero of the dispossessed, did not fade. It evolved. It hardened into the Garrison Don of the 1970s, the political enforcer of the 1980s, the narco-garrison operator of the 1990s and 2000s. Christopher Dudas Koch understood it. Lester Jim Brown Koch understood it. Aston Bucky Marshall understood it. Claude Massup understood it. They were all, in some structural sense, operating within a framework that Reijing had sketched in the pages of the Daily Gleaner in 6 furious weeks in 1948. The framework of the man who controls the narrative of his own power, who turns his fugitive status into a performance, who makes the state look slow and brutal and incompetent, while the people of the yards watch and decide which side of that story they want to be on. None of them would have called it that. None of them would have traced the lineage consciously. But the academic paper published in the Art Journal in 2018 made the case explicitly that the specific social, political, and institutional conditions of Jamaican colonial and post-colonial history, the histories of archival disappearance and capture and fugitivity, all fed directly into how Reijing's image and story were visualized, embodied, and reperformed across time and media and geography. The photograph that Miss Brown took and handed to the police, the image of a small man with 2 revolvers drawn, staring into the lens, became through the film, through the album cover, through decades of cultural citation and reperformance, one of the most recognizable iconographic templates in Caribbean popular culture. It was arguably the first deliberately constructed gangster image in Jamaican history. It was constructed by the subject himself, for his own purposes, under conditions of maximum danger. The question that the network of silence raises, the question of who was watching from those trees, who kept him fed in the swamps of St. Catherine for weeks, who arranged the passage on the Gloria again, and may or may not have arranged passage to Cuba, that question was alive in the yards through all of this. It was alive when the Rude Boys were building their reputations in the sound system dances. It was alive when Perry Henzel was casting Jimmy Cliff in a story that needed a man who could make the audience feel, in their chests, what it meant to have no legitimate path and decide to make one anyway. It was alive in the 2018 academic analysis of how the photograph became a template for a century of Jamaican outlawry. And it remains alive now, because the answer was never given, and the people who knew it are decades dead and buried without markers of their own. The authorities buried Reijing's body under a number in May Penn Cemetery and told the crowd it was going to Spanish Town. They wanted no shrine. They wanted no pilgrimage point. They wanted the name to dry up and blow away with the scrub grass of the paupers section. Instead, something else happened. The name did not shrink. It expanded. It passed from the rum bars into the record shops, from the record shops into the cinemas, from the cinemas into the university lecture halls of Britain and America, from the lecture halls into the critical vocabulary of Caribbean cultural studies, from there into the global understanding of reggae, of Jamaican cinema, of what it means for a man with no institutional power to pick up a newspaper and use it as a weapon against the institution that wants him dead. Lucilda Young is buried somewhere, too. And Jonathan Thomas, and Detective Corporal Edgar Lewis, who had a funeral with a national hero as pallbearer and died doing a job in which he believed. The cost of Reijing's 6 weeks was real. And it was specific, and it was paid by people who had nothing to do with the system he was raging against. That cost belongs inside the story, not outside it. The folk hero narrative that the yards built around Vincent Martin was built, in part, over graves it preferred not to name. What cannot be undone is this: a 24-year-old man who grew up in the compressed poverty of colonial West Kingston, who taught himself the grammar of outlawry from American detective novels and Hollywood westerns, who escaped from a British prison in his underwear and then wrote letters to the newspapers about it, became through a combination of genuine audacity, deliberate self-mythologizing, and the collective grievance of a people who had been given nothing and expected less. The original template for what Jamaica would call the rude boy, the Don, the bad man, the legend. He did not survive long enough to see what he had started. He never knew his name would appear on records and film posters and in academic journals. He died on a sand quay in Kingston Harbor at 24, shot 5 times in the head, and the only number that marked his resting place was a digit in a municipal record. But in the yards where he had moved and hidden and been protected and been feared and been loved, in the rum bars where they read his letters aloud over the noise of the morning, he was already something else. He was already the idea, and the idea, as every subsequent decade of Jamaican history would confirm, was considerably harder to kill than the man. All major factual claims in this story are confirmed across at least 3 reputable sources: the Wikipedia entry on ridging, the Jamaica Observer investigative feature, the C. Roy Reynolds 4-part series published in the Jamaica Gleaner, December 2000, archived via Heather Augustin's Scabook.com research, the Wikipedia entry on The Harder They Come, the Criterion Collection, essay by Justine Henzel, Wikipedia on the Rude Boy subculture, Basque Culture's Cultural Analysis, the Art Journal academic paper on Rijing and Photographic Disappearance, and the Columbia University academic source on the evolution of political violence in Jamaica.